here on page 50. It's a study of the Veda. Let him wake in the Muhurta sacred to Brahman and think of the acquisition of spiritual merit and wealth and the bodily fatigue arising therefrom and of the true meaning of the Veda. So in the Brahma Muhurta, then he's thinking of spiritual development, right? That, the true meaning of the Veda. But he's also thinking of wealth, right? But this wealth he's looking at in the position of how much difficulty it creates. In other words, the need for material facility is a problem, right? And so that means that it's it itself. So the idea is it reduces the need for it. Not that it reduces the enthusiasm to work for it, but you still want it. Right? Does that make sense? Because the point is, desire gives rise to needs, gives rise to endeavor. You lose the desire, you lose the need, you lose the endeavor. Like that. So that's the... Not that, oh, it's trouble, so I give up the endeavor. Like that. So that, yeah, doesn't mean that. It just means that the idea slowly, slowly, the real purpose of the Veda becomes prominent and the absorption in material life becomes reduced. When he has risen, has relieved his necessities of nature and carefully purified himself, let him stand during the morning twilight, muttering for a long time the Gayatri, and at the proper time he must similarly perform the evening devotion. By prolonging the twilight devotions, the sages obtained long life, wisdom, honor, fame, and excellence in Vedic knowledge. Right? So the evening twilight devotions means the chanting of japa. So the morning and evening should be specifically dedicated to that. The day, then, we can do so many other activities. But these two times, the two twilights, you know, at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, those are especially good for chanting, right? Like that. Yearly course of study. You had something? No. Okay. Having performed the upakarma according to the prescribed rule on the full moon of the month Shravana, or on that of the Paushtapada, Bhadrapada, a Brahmana shall diligently study the Vedas during 4.5 months. Right. So upakarma means when they begin the Vedic study. So this time from the middle of basically, it's like in Shravan or in Bhadra, these 2 months, then they start the Vedic study. And that goes up until the, Vasant Panchami. That time, so it's 4.5 months, is specifically mentioned. But then if you start earlier, then it's 5.5. Those months, those are the when one can study the best. The focus is the greatest. So very detailed study in something very, difficult, analytical or something like that. So the Veda would be studied at that time. Then the other months, what is left, right, either the 7.5 or 6.5, that would be for any other kind of study, you know, any other lighter material, right? So they're considering the Veda and its understanding as the main, and then, you know, basically all other things would be done the other months. That way that in studying you focus, and instead of trying to do everything at once, you do certain things at one time that are more, you know, essential, more foundational, and then at the other times you do the variety of subjects that are left. Because otherwise if you try to do everything at once, you can never get everything in. It doesn't fit. And then what happens is the variety never happens because you give preference to the important subjects, but the important subjects aren't done to that degree that it ever leaves any time for the variety. So in this way, the Veda says that the really essential, important, foundational things are studied during this 4.5 months exclusively, and then during the other time, then you will review them, but you won't study anything new. You'll only review what you already know. And then the rest of the time is spent on studying all these new variety of things. That way, because over so many years, you study so many small subjects, you know a lot of things. but they wouldn't fit in if you tried to do them on a, you know, a yearly basis. You understand? That means the whole year you do the same schedule, it won't fit. Does that make sense? You know, plus outside of this time, the focus is not as great. One likes different things, lighter things, and during this time, focus is very good, so we can really focus on very, you know, like you want to learn Sanskrit grammar, learn it at this time. And then the other times, learn lighter things.
Is this in the winter, this 4.5 month, or in the summer? I don't
know. It would start, means it's either starting basically around August, July, August, September, one of those two, it's starting, and it's ending basically end of January, beginning of February. It just depends, because these are moon months, and so it'll move with the moon. So it's just when these full moon days are there, then you start, right? In other words, it's either in the second, you either start in the second month of the Chaturmas or in the third month of the Chaturmas on those full moons, like that. When the Pushya day of the month Pausha, or the first day of the bright half of the Magga, has come, a Brahmana shall perform in the forenoon the Utsargana of the Vedas. Having performed the Utsargana outside the village, as the institutes of the sacred law prescribe, he shall stop reading during 2 days and the intervening night, or during that day of the Utsarga and the following night. Afterwards, he shall diligently recite the Vedas during the bright halves of the moons and duly study all the Angas of the Vedas during the dark fortnights. So, because in here they're memorizing the Veda. So that means during when going from new moon to full moon, then one is going over and reciting all the whatever he knows. And then during the other half, from the full moon to the new moon, then he's learning all the new material. So it's just a matter of what you know. So here you're talking about someone knows thousands of verses, so therefore they'll be repeating them and, you know, looking at them, making sure it's right. But if that's not the case, it doesn't take so much time, then you make sure that time is done for revision or review, and then the rest of the time is spent for new subjects. Does that make sense? Like that. Let him not recite the text indistinctly, nor in the presence of Shudras, nor let him, if in the latter part of the night he is tired with reciting the Veda, go again to sleep. Right? So in other words, you don't get up in the morning for Brahma Muhurta and then get tired from this and go back to sleep. Right? You know, you should make sure you're rested enough that you're going to get through the whole Brahma Muhurta. Right? Yes. Oh, no. According to the rule declared above, let him recite the daily portion of the mantras, and a zealous Brahman who is not in distress shall study the Brahmana and the mantra Samhita. Right. The Brahman is how you apply it in rituals, and the mantra Samhita is the recitation of the verses themselves. Let a twice-born man always carefully interpret the Veda study interrupt the Veda study on two occasions. Namely, when the place where he recites is impure and when he himself is unpurified. Okay, now we'll go, personal behavior continued. We go back to what was before, because this came out to be the study of the Veda. Now we go back to different things. Okay, continence. A twice-born man who is a snotika shall remain chaste on the new moon day, on the eighth lunar day of each half month, on the full moon day, and the 14th, even if they fall in the period proper for conjugal union. Let him not bathe immediately after a meal, nor when he is sick, nor in the middle of the night, nor frequently dressed in all his garments, nor in a pool which he does not perfectly know, right? Because all these would be bad for the health. So if you bathe right after a meal, then it's bad for the digestion, like that. When he's sick, then you don't necessarily take a full bath. You take a half bath or make sure that it's hot water. You know, and so, in other words, it shouldn't be there. One should purify oneself, but one should be careful about how much he's taking bath there. In the middle of the night, he's not taking a bath, nor frequently dressed in all his garments, because you have... after performing these big Shrauta yagyas and all that, then when they finish with all their clothes, they'll take bath. Or you see something that's improper, or this or that, they'll take bath with their clothes on. So all these things are ways to purify, so that shouldn't be done too often like that. So you should take that into consideration, right? In a pool that you don't know, because you might slip in there, there might be rocks, it might be deeper than you think, or so many things like that. Yes? No, but then he's up. Middle of the night means, you know, get up, you have to go to the toilet, then you take a bath, then you go back to bed. You don't do stuff like that.
Jumping into the Yamuna or Ganga.
But if you don't know them, then people have broken their necks or have died. In Mayapur, every year someone drowns or something in the Ganga because they don't know it. You know, they just jump in. You know what I'm saying? People will say anything to create their own religion. And then in areas where it is important to be strict, they're not strict at all. And in areas that they have perceived that it's not good, in other words, they don't like jumping, so no one should jump. So then they create these things. You know what I'm saying? That's the difficulty, is we're so apt to take something and then take it down the line three or four steps and then make it into this, like, dictatorial absolute rule that if you don't follow it, everything's, you know, finished in devotional service, when actually in most cases no one even considers it. Like in India, no one considers that you can't jump into the Ganga and do these things. But if you were doing some ritual and you were doing a ritualistic bath like that, you wouldn't jump. You would go in nicely in that. But if after that, or it's another time of the day, you know, like that, then you might do that. It's just, in other words, when it's time to be formal, you do that. So they're getting this is from the Radha Kund, goes into this, goes into anything, goes into anywhere, and Krishna's the ocean, so no, you know, like that. And, you know, so it's unnecessary. You know what I'm saying? Point is that there's the element of respect, you know, is there, but the point is that playing in water is also pretty standard, like that. It's just a matter of what it is. So the Ganga, she's like mother, this and that. The Radhakund is Radharani. So it's not that you just go in to have some fun. You're dealing with Radharani. She's the boss. So there's a difference between her and Ganga Devi or Jamuna Devi. Right? We have to be able to make a distinction between these. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
How long does it take to chant Gayatri? Is that here? Or should chant long?
But this is meaning because that is their japa. That's why I always use the word japa. I don't say chanting Gayatri. Because you're going to chant your Gayatri. But for us, the japa is the Hare Krishna mantra. But in this case, it's the Brahma Gayatri. That is their japa. So they'll chant 1,000 of them like that. Generally, that means they're asleep or something. If they're awake, I don't know how it's possible. You know, Gayatri generally takes about 3 minutes. Yeah, but if it's too slow, it's just like Prabhupada mentioned, chanting a round of the Maha Mantra, that 5 minutes is like ideal. Slower than that means you're spacing out or not focusing, and quicker than that means you might not concentrate. So that's like, you know, considered a general average good time. You know, if someone has been chanting a long time as practice, then it may speed up, be quicker than that. But the general thing is that, so if they take something that should only take 3 minutes and they do it in half an hour, that doesn't make it more devotional, you know, necessarily, unless the person is such a focused person and very mature and sober. But if they're one of those spaced out guys that, you know, he does that on everything, you know, it takes him 3 hours to, you know, boil water. Then it's just they're spaced out. We laugh, but it, you know, it takes time, you know. You know. Yes. Well, Brahma Muhurta is, that's when we chant our japa generally. But if you have time in that also, then you can also read then. But otherwise, you find some other time in the morning or evening or.
What is the best time?
The best time is whenever you have time. That's the best time.
So what is the proper etiquette when it comes to Radhakund and Shyamkund? Because I've been at different times, and sometimes the guide has said, like, the first time I was there, you just jump, not jump in. But
you never jump in. The point is it's Radharani, so you don't just jump in. Yeah. Everything's there is very reverential.
And then the second time or something, we came after the full parikrama, we put our feet down, and then we got really, like, shouted.
No, but you don't stick your feet into the, because that's just hanging out and just, you know, cooling your feet off. So you're taking service. You know, it's not. Point is if you're going in, your feet have to go in first, right? Unless you know something we don't. You can go in, you know, head first or something. So you go in, but you're going in respectfully. Just dip into the water and then come out. That's the way we deal with like that. That was very tricky. You see how she did it? She didn't mention this part. She only mentioned the other. So then what, like that. And then when you say, so if you go in, you go in like this. So it is okay to bathe. That was very, very clever.
Some people say that you can only take a few drops and put it on your head.
Only a few drops. You shouldn't take more than a few, right? What if we take a loader or something and drip it in and take a full bath on the side? See, it's just a matter of the situation, who you're dealing with, and everything like this. See, Prabhupada made this point because the devotees don't make any distinctions. So they went there to bathe, and they're just jumping off the thing and yelling and screaming and shouting and just playing. So this Prabhupada said, don't bathe. Because this is not the thing where, okay, you made a mistake, so we'll work on it again. This is one of those things that you don't deal like that. This is Radharani, so therefore better you guys don't bathe. You know what I'm saying? So the point is if you understand how to bathe, then there's not really a problem. Okay? But that means it's formal. You just go there, offer your obeisances, sprinkle water on your head, go in, dip into the water, come out, and then you're done. Does that make sense? So if you understand that, it works nicely. You don't understand that, better you stay on the side and just sprinkle water on your head. But if someone feels that they don't want to go in, so they don't want to put their feet there, then they take the water and just pour it on their head. So devotees have that attitude, and it's not considered wrong. Like that. So if you're with those who do like that or just sprinkle water, do that. And if you're with those who will bathe properly, then you do that. Does that make sense? You know, so because we have to be very, very careful. Somehow or another is we have this tendency, it's of Niyamagraha, it's absolute one way or absolute, you know, we don't need it or it's not necessarily. But this idea of this element of gradation according to the situation is somehow or another, it's in general very difficult for the neophyte devotees, but it's especially difficult for those who basically, it seems to be more the Western mind. You know what I'm saying? There's somehow the overbearing on rules. You know, it's either you're overbearing on it or you're a revolutionary, one or the other, because that's all there is in history, right? The person who misuses the rules in their favor or the one who misuses the rules against authority. There doesn't seem to be a history or tradition of those who, you know, just comfortably follow the rules. Right? Because if you did, there'd be nothing for historians to write on. And then, you know, that whole department in the academy would, you know, fall into disuse. So. Does that make sense? You know, so see the situation and act accordingly. Like that. In other words, you're not going to get from me that he said this. No, you're not going to get it. Okay, let him not bathe that immediately after a meal. So that means if you have to do puja after the meal, means you've worn clothes that you're not going to wear during the puja, right? Then after eating, you wash your hands, mouth, and feet, put on those clothes you're going to use for puja, and then go do the puja. this idea that, no, it's a higher standard to take a bath, that's not anywhere. This is one of those, one more of those Western made-up religious rules that have nothing to do with anything anywhere in Shastra. Because right here, Manu says, you let them not bathe immediately after a meal. Yes. Then you might take a bath, but that generally means you're not healthy. Prabhupada says if after eating you pass urine, and when you go to sleep you immediately fall asleep at night, then your health is good. But if you can't fall asleep and you pass stool after eating, you're sick. Like that. Does that make sense? If that happens, then you take your bath, and you know, like that. Does that make sense? Yes.
What about Maharaj? It says that you should brush your teeth after the meal, so...
That's generally... It said?
In Pansarata,
it's generally done in the morning when you get up, and then you can do it again at the evening bath. So it's not connected with the meal specifically. Devotees practice that way because if they were a little bit inclined to follow rules, then they did that because that's what their, you know, the dentist said, and that's what their third grade teacher said, and that's what, you know, like that. So they develop that practice from there. But it's connected with the baths, not with the eating. You know what I'm saying? So the morning bath, you know, and then the evening bath. You know, after the day, then you come back, then you can brush your teeth, take a bath. And then you know, for the evening program and, you know, everything else, the family life and all those things. It's not connected with eating. Because noontime, you're not supposed to brush your teeth. Because it's bad for the teeth because of the sun. Like that. So it's generally connected there. It's not to do with... Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Let him not intentionally step on the shadow of images of the gods, of a guru, of a king, of a snataka, of his teacher, or a reddish-brown animal, I mean generally like a cow, or one who has been initiated to the performance of Shraddha sacrifice. Okay. At midday and at midnight, after partaking of a meal at a funeral dinner, and in the... excuse me. And in the two twilights, let him not stay long on a crossroad. Right, so because we said the crossroads are where the yakshas, that's where they get to live. And the time that they'll generally be there are at these Sundays, right? The morning, evening, twilight, or at the noon and midnight. Right, so this practice, Western practice, where all the boys go and hang out down on the corner at the crossroads in the evening, you know, to watch all the girls and just like that. So that's not recommended. Like that. Let him not step intentionally on things used for cleansing the body, on water used for a bath, on urine or hors d'oeuvre, on blood, on mucus, or on anything spat out or vomited. In other words, don't step on anything that's pure, that would be used for cleaning, and don't step on anything that's impure. Right? Like that. So that's the... Let him not show particular attention to an enemy, to the friend of an enemy, to a wicked man, to a thief, or to the wife of another man. Because the enemy means particular attention, just means how much you have to pay, then that much you do. But more than that, you don't, because anything more than that, then you have to discuss something that's not necessary to discuss with them. And whatever you discuss, they may use against you. Right? Does that make sense? You know, enemy, friend of an enemy, because he'll tell the enemy, then the enemy will use it. You know, the friend, he may be fine, but he's his friend, so he talks and this and that. A wicked man, you don't know what he's going to say or do. You don't want his association anyway. A thief, you know, because then they'll try to become friendly and then find their way into your facility, or they may take things you say, or, you know, like that. Or the wife of another man. It means someone else's wife, you don't pay particular attention. Right? It means just whatever's formally dealt with in that, that's how much. More than that, then one doesn't. So
it's vice versa?
Basically, she doesn't go out of the way, yes, like that. It means if there's some service or something like that, then it's not a problem. It means, but it says particular attention, you know, so it means you're going out of your way to spend that time and give that attention. For in this world, there's nothing so detrimental to long life as criminal conversation with another man's wife. So criminal conversation means it's beyond what's necessary. It's not part of the service, it's not part of the relationship, so it's, that makes sense? Yes. If they're there with the other person, if there's families, then it's there. But if it's just, you know, one man and someone else's wife, they wouldn't sit there and hang out for hours and talk and like that. They wouldn't do that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
Jumping over the shadow of Tulsi in the temple room, is it proper interpretation of this?
Jumping over. Jumping over. Why wouldn't they step on? So we jump over. So we jump over.
Well, no, I just have seen that it is.
That's what I'm just saying. Is I'm impressed, like that. It means in India they would go if they were worried about they go around, right? But somehow the Westerners, because they're so pragmatic, you know, and practical, that it would be longer to walk around. You might get more benefit, right? Because step by step you destroy the killing of a Brahmin, so you might get an extra two or three steps by going around, and that wouldn't be so good. So you'll jump over because you're not supposed to step on. The point is this, that respect of. It's not saying intentionally. If you don't notice, it doesn't matter. So for those people who don't understand this, they walk around, step on the shadow, there's no big deal. For those who understand this, can relate to that, then if they notice, they avoid it. But if they don't, you know, so that way also is that one could consider putting enough lights in the temple room that there are no shadows. Then everybody can peacefully walk around, because otherwise you always have their standard one of, you know, the Tulsi Puja, and the only light that works is way over in the corner, so there's this shadow that goes all the way across over to here, and nobody can get around. You slide around the wall and, you know, get to... Yeah, so then, you know, put in the proper lighting if people know about it. And if they don't know about it, don't worry about it. Like that. But jumping over, no. You go. It's either you go around or you don't worry about it. But jumping over, how is that somehow another respectful, right? Because I jumped over, right? I took the effort to jump over. Let him who desires prosperity, indeed, never despise a kshatriya, a snake, and a learned Brahmin, be they ever so feeble. Right? So these three never deal badly with. Right? The kshatriya, a snake, or a learned Brahmin. Even though they may not be strong at all at the time, it's a small snake, or it's a, you know, Kshatriya is, you know, he's young by nature, I mean by age, or he's not in a prominent position, or like that, or the Brahmin is not physically very strong, or he's not in a good social position in the way of, you know, influence or management. One doesn't do that. Because these three, when treated with disrespect, may utterly destroy him. Hence, a wise man must never despise them, right? Because that kshatriya will grow up, and he won't forget, you know, like that. You know, and you insult a Brahmin, then, you know, not that he'll bother you, but, you know, the modes of nature will. And if he does decide to bother you, then you got problems, right? Look what happened to King Nanda when he upset Chanakya, like that. Yeah, and snakes, that's pretty obvious. Yes.
How the snakes relate to the statement of Bhagavatam that even the holy man rejoice when the snake or scorpion is killed?
It said despise means deal badly with.
Despise means like contempt, right?
It means you're not dealing properly. So don't deal improperly with the snake. So either you go around it, you know, or if it's in a dangerous situation, you kill it if it's poisonous. But the point is that you wouldn't just, you know, go up and give it a kick because it's a snake, or step on it or something, because they remember, they'll come and get you. They're not. See, we always have to remember animals, their stupidity is not their material ability to do things. Their foolishness is their inability to see the spiritual. So when it comes to eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and so in this case defending, they tend to be better at it than we are. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the point. So it's not that they don't know what's going on. They can tell when you're behaving nicely and when you're not. It's not that they're an animal, so they're stupid, they won't know. They perceive all these things. Yes.
Is learned Brahmana means Vaishnava only, or?
No, learned Brahmana means any. If they're a practicing Brahmana, then you don't bother them.
But can you criticize him behind his back? That's
why would you criticize him?
But like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he criticized caste Brahmanas.
He would criticize them to their face.
Yeah.
But how did he criticize them? By, it means, in that book, Vaishnava and Brahmana, right? The first thing that he did when he came is he gave from the Vedas and Upanishads, you know, whatever literatures they would appreciate, he gave all the glories of the Brahman and the position of the Brahman. So they were very pleased. You know, he had established from all Shastras why the Brahman is the best. So there's no more quotes. You can't bring in another one to say that, you know, their greatness. He's already quoted them all. And therefore they were very happy, and in their minds, well, he had established that the Brahmins are better. Then he went and started then bringing out the verses that established that the Vaishnava is better than the Brahmin. So if we say Vaishnava is automatically a Brahmin, when we say a learned Brahmin, then we mean a Brahmin. And that also includes Vaishnavas, because they're automatically Brahmins. Because you have learned Brahmins who aren't necessarily Vaishnavas. They get up in the morning, they do all these, whatever rules we're talking about here. There are people who do this today. And they're pure, and their habits, their eating, their lifestyle, they are there today. So that they're not devotees, that's unfortunate. So much piety and that, but they're not devotees, that's unfortunate. But they're still Brahmins, and they're still dear to Krishna, because they're following the rules, and they're setting a good example, and others can learn from that. Now all you have to do is add Krishna, and then it becomes perfect. So there are Brahmins. It means in the West, you know, basically you have Mlechas and Yavanas, so the only real Brahmins you have are devotees. But in India, you have, you know, tens of thousands or more of properly behaved traditional Brahmins. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's a huge community, the Gaur Saraswat, the Saraswat Brahmins. So as a community, they do all these things. You know, that makes sense. We have one guy who comes in Mayapur, Sanskrit Ananda. It's called, because he just speaks Sanskrit. His whole thing, he's dedicated himself to teaching Sanskrit spoken. He's one of those, you know, kind of like Jai Hind Wallas, you know. And so, and he's a Brahmin, you know, has turban and everything like this. He's very pukka, does everything. He loves hanging around in ISKCON because of all, we're one of the only ones that maintains and cultivates Brahminical culture. But he's not a Vaishnav. But he very much appreciates what we do because we follow the Vedic culture. Like that. Does that make sense? So he's you know, always hangs around, you know, takes care of cows and does the whole, you know, all these auspicious things. You know what I'm saying? So you do have them. And the honest ones appreciate what we're doing because they see that we're, you know, the Vedic culture. They don't understand the importance of the Vaishnav aspect, but they appreciate what we're doing because of the culture. Is that okay? Let him not despise himself on account of former failures. Until death, let him seek fortune, nor despair of gaining it. Right, so this is a very important point. point, is that he should not despise himself on account of his failure. The point is it's despising yourself because of your failure doesn't add anything to your confidence to do something now about changing it. The point is one's done something wrong, correct it. But that doesn't mean you have to despise yourself to correct it. That's a cultural, aspect of the mode of ignorance. This idea is that, well, you've only reformed if you say, I'm so disgusting, and roll on the ground and beat yourself and all that. If we notice, if we go back, you know, the only place I've heard of this being, you know, like official is in, you know, the Middle Ages and stuff like that, especially during the bubonic plague. People would, you know, with chains, whip themselves because they're so sinful. And in China, where they expect that the person in public will say he's so disgusting and bad and break down and cry and fall on the ground. And then after he's done all that, then they'll shoot him, right? So does that make sense? So these are the only two places I've ever heard of it that it's like officially considered something important like that. But repentant means I'm not going to do this anymore. So repentance means that's foolish. Now I'm not going to do this anymore. But they just went, I'm so bad. I'm so disgusting. I'm so this. I'm so that. But where's the change? All they want you to do is, you know, you made me feel bad. Now I want you to feel bad. If you feel bad, that's just. Not change is the thing. Because if you change, you're prospering. And how could someone who's done this ever prosper? So you see, it's based on envy. That's all. It's based on themselves, their own sense of justice and envy. It's not dharma. That may hold some value to those who are on pranamoy, who are on the platform of artha, right? Because we said morality, justice, and economics. Those three are three aspects of one mentality, right? So if all people are talking about is money and justice, and if somebody does something wrong because it's morally wrong, then you know the level of consciousness. It's easy. It's right there. You know what I'm saying? So, because dharma means what's the inherent nature of some? What's the inherent nature of a Brahmin? To do something wrong or to do something right? So if he's doing something wrong, means he's fallen out of doing his duty. So what would be the proper thing according to nature? Establish him in his duty, if it's possible. If he's too super attached to his improper behavior, then that becomes his new nature, and you have to re-identify him in that way. You know what I'm saying? Let's say he takes up business, and then now is an opportunity to again get back into his natural brahminical occupation, but he doesn't want to because he wants that facility and that social prestige and everything. Then he has to identify himself as a Vaishya. Then he can go on like that. He doesn't have to change. He just has to do it. Does that make sense? So this is there because the point is being in the material world means you're already bad. So we're trying to cultivate good. We're taking it that the material world is inherently good. And then somebody's broken the rules, so that's a great offense because the material world is good. But no, the material world is bad. And so if someone will do good, that's special. Being bad, everybody's bad. That's normal. You look out, everybody's bad. That's why he's saying the Brahmin doesn't take part. He's in the ways of the world. So the ways of the world are this mundane justice also. That's also one of the ways of the world. Because technically we call it morality, but it's actually ethics. So ethics is also how you deal with something according to the law, not just your feeling that it's bad. You know what I'm saying?
What happens when somebody despises himself in the public because he's forced to by the society for something he has...
Well, I would say is it won't be so good for him. It'll cause some... One, it may, depending upon if he's naturally a strong personality, then afterwards he'll feel okay because he'll have, you know, admitted things. Now he's things are out in the open. But the people who expected him to do that, thinking that that will be actually a way of upliftment, I wouldn't want to think about what will happen to them. Because it's not a method. If the person was a Shudra, okay, they may not get too much of a problem. But if they're, you know, a properly situated devotee, or they're, you know, they have, especially if within devotional, they have a brahminical nature, you're messing with things here that are way beyond one's pranamoyic ability to understand. No, apologizing, no, you've done something wrong, you apologize. Despising is that it affects one's identity. You know, they want you to say, I am a bad person. And we're not a bad person, we're the soul. We're not this body. You know, because of mundane consciousness of I am the controller and enjoyer, which it's going to be hard to find someone around here that doesn't have that, is that one by habit got overly distracted by an aspect of the mundane identity. And from that, one became engaged in an activity that goes with that mentality that's not useful to devotional service. Because the problem with something being what we would call immoral is it's useless for devotional service. It's not that its morality stands on its own, that it has a value. You know what I'm saying? That someone is engaged not in illicit sex, what's the big deal if it's not connected to Krishna? Is there any animal, bug, you know, reptile, bird, or fish on the planet who has illicit sex? No, there's not one. Because according to their season, they engage in the process. Other than that, they don't. You know what I'm saying? So if that was the case, then, you know, what piety would be there in all these living entities? But it's no big deal because it's not connected to the Veda. It's not connected to Krishna consciousness. So here we're not connecting to Krishna consciousness, and we're not even connecting to the Veda. Because why is it morally wrong? This guy ran off with that guy's wife. Why? What is the problem? What's the real problem? Right? They weren't happy. And now they're together, they're happy. So if happiness, which is the Western thing, is to become happy, they're happy now. So you would think, wow, hey, this is great. Yet everything worked out. What's wrong with it?
Because I would like to do that also, but I cannot.
Yeah, so is that a reason, therefore, that because he got away with it and I'd like to do it, but I'm not going to do it, so now he should be punished? Mm-hmm. That was the point of why, you know, the preacher said, whoever wants to, you know, throw the first stone, make sure you're not doing that. And everybody dropped the stones and walked off. Because the point is all it was is she got caught. They hadn't. Because if I get up there and yell and scream about something, then it makes it look like, yes, I'm not doing it. But much of the time, you will find that the person who has such a strong feelings of morality then are of two types. One is they are born into this kind of Brahmin family or Kshatriya family or like that, like is said here. And even vice versa, just a quality family where there's no question of anybody ever at any time in their family doing anything immoral. They can't relate to it at all. You know, and they don't have a very deep understanding, so it's a bit ritualistic. But they have a right. If they say like this, I won't complain, because that is their reality. Generally, it's the others. They have that taint themselves, and they are reacting because that's their proclivity.
They are hypocrites.
Yes, a hypocrite. So it may be that they're not doing it now, but they were, so that's why it resonates so much with them, because they were doing that nonsense, and now they're not. So therefore, now no one could do that. But the point is that was their nonsense. Someone else has a different nonsense. Prabhupada says, philosophical deviation is worse than sensual. But we'll turn it the other way around. People can talk all kinds of philosophy. Yeah, what's wrong with, you know, saying Prabhupada didn't know what he's talking about? You know, we're just having an open discussion. No, that's nonsense. But that will be discussed at the top levels of our society. But if somebody does something wrong with the senses, oh, that's it, they're finished, eternally. So how is that in line with the Torah? So we're seeing that the sensual is worse than the philosophical. We don't even identify the philosophical as wrong. Yes.
So this is about condemnation of self.
Yes.
But it's the same. How are you?
Yeah, in condemning others. It means if you are in charge of the person, then you can condemn the activity, but not the person. In other words, you know, what's that, the famous one? Hate the sin, not the sinner. Right? Because the point is the sin's the sin. That's just what it is. That's its definition. That's what it does for a living. Right? But someone to be involved in it, that's the problem. So the point is it's not to be involved. So if someone was involved, why are they involved? Right? Did they have enough association? Was everything going nicely? You know, like that. What happened? How did they get distracted? And being distracted, do they want to continue with that distraction, or they see that it's a problem and move on? Right? Does that make sense? Like he had problem. Madhudvisa. He got involved with some lady, and then he said, you know, this is how it works. You have two choices. Do you want to be with this? Do you find that you have the need to be with this lady? And if so, then get married and then continue doing the exact same service you're doing. Right? So instead of doing sannyasa, do it as a grihastha. Or if you see that, okay, that was I got distracted, that was stupid. No, I feel I will do better as a sannyasi. I don't need to be, you know, like this. Then you just continue as a sannyasi and stay away from the girl. It was that simple. But we'll make it into, no, once you've done that, then, you know, it's like we can't handle anything outside of a ritual because that's all we're seeing is ritual. But here we're dealing with dharma. What is the dharma, the nature of what the person naturally does? It's not that one thing then wipes out everything good. Yes?
The political parties, if they have a member who has some scandal, then it's written all over and people will not vote for that party, therefore they get rid of this member.
Yeah, but it's political, it's not devotional. We're not dealing with politics here. We're not dealing with votes. So what? Tell them that, yes. Notice the words they use. It's political. So what? Is this a political party? Is this democracy? Everyone makes up their own process?
People will have a bad opinion.
Who is this people? I want to know who are these people. Who are these people?
Devotees in general.
Which devotees in general? I haven't met them. I have not met them.
On the Facebook.
You know, and so what? Now that's the standard?
There are millions of them.
There are not millions of them. There's you and your few friends. That's who it is. Be real. It's not many. It's you and a couple of your God brothers. And that's it. There aren't many. That's it. One guy in LA, one guy up in San Diego, someone up north in San Francisco, maybe a guy up in Seattle, one or two on the East Coast, and that's it. There aren't any more. The general devotee, you know, just wants to know that there's shelter in this society. If they do something wrong, then they'll be supported. You know what I'm saying? You see in the Christian church is that they have a monastery just for priests, you know, and monks that are having problem with the regulative principles. They get too much into their, you know, daily allotment of their little bit of wine, or they get too much distracted by sexual engagement. They go to this monastery to work and get it together. They don't kick them out. So do we have such facility? Do we have something to reform or help someone? No, we have these stupid things that if you don't lead a kirtan, you don't give a class, you know, you don't initiate, and you know, ideally you go to another planet, but we can't somehow or another get that one enforced just yet. So we'll stick to these three. Then, you know, oh, and you can't manage. Yeah, that's right. You know, then somehow or another that'll purify one of anything. Right? And if that was the case, then basically except for the management one, all the karmis on the planet would be so purified from not leading kirtan, you know, not going to the temple, not doing these. They'd be so ripe for Krishna consciousness. But what they don't understand is prayaschitta, one, our consideration of it is, one, it's bogus. It's not even an option. That's what the sixth canto is about. Someone should try reading it. Ajamil, you don't get worse than Ajamil. So the point is it comes up as, what's the use of prayaschitta? And he makes this point, there isn't any. And therefore, and then he tells the story of Ajamil. Like that. The point of this is only for those persons who aren't broad-minded enough to be able to see that someone who commits a fault by the chanting process and association of devotees can come up. So they're just moralistically minded. It's not devotional. It's pranamoy. Bas. And much of the time, it's not even a pure pranamoy. It's something with some serious personal issues. So it has nothing to do with devotional service, our process, the Bhagavatam, nothing. They've created it themselves because of the neophyte mentality. And then to quote the politicians, like that. How is it that here we're quoting the politicians, but the methods that we use, you know, for trying to uplift and make our society successful, those are the Vaishyas. Why don't they stick to, you know, how is it, you know, our social is created by the politicians, and our, you know, management is created by the Vaishyas, you know, the businessmen. You know, what's reality here? Because it's a political party. You know, so are we a political party? If that's the case, then why can't we vote for these people and why can't we vote them out?
It's not that what is said, but this is the logic behind it.
It's not logic. It's not, it is normal if you're a politician. What happens if in a big family you have a whole bunch of people and one member of the family gets into something? Let's say, you know, one of the cousins, you know, got into, you know, some heavy drug use and all that. So then he's just thrown out of the family because that way all the family members would feel better. Or, no, they try to figure out how to do, maybe he could stay with this one or that one, they could try to give some support until he gets himself together and he becomes a full-fledged member of the family. That's what used to happen. Right? You understand it? But from 87, then instead of following God's laws, they're making their own. And unfortunately, God doesn't seem to buy it, because if they did buy it, why is it there's no prosperity? All those people doing all those bad things, and the society has never been growing faster and more established, all the things that they want. But they're missing the point, is it goes by Vaishnav etiquette, a respective authority, knowing the scriptures, proper behavior. That's why we're going through this. One may say, well, what has all this got to do with management? It's got everything to do with management, because all the mistakes that are being made in management are made on these points alone. Besides someone being a good manager or not. But that's an individual thing. But here is, so many of these points that are being made here, they're not important. Or they're even going against. So the point is administration has to be based on Dharma. Because they'll say, well, no, but that's material. And so the political party of America is spiritual, right? You know? And all these business, you know, Vaishya, you know, techniques of management, those are spiritual. No, there's Yukta Vairagya. So were Yukta Vairagya Manu, which Prabhupada recommends. Is that okay? You understand? So the difficulty comes is that what is Western religion? Is it really religion? As in Dharma? No, it's Upadharma. So where is it settled? In pranamoy. So the only religious experience anybody has is pranamoy. And they'll call it spiritual. It's not. You know, the spiritual experience will be your connection with God, not your connection with this set of rituals that are created. I mean, are the Christian rituals designated in the Bible? No. They've just somehow or another developed them by their practices, by their habit. You know, they're in pursuance of something in there, but they've created them. But let's take someone like the Jews. Are those created? No. Those are there, down to their underwear, it's discussed. You know what I'm saying? So they've created it. So you have this system where man creates ritual, he situates himself in pranamoy, and he says it's spiritual. Sound familiar? Right? And then because of that, because that's our habit, then when we come in contact with the Krishna conscious, actual Shastric thing, we'll say it's not practical, or nobody's into that. Nobody meaning nobody wants to switch from the mundane approach to the actual spiritual. That means, as you see, we go through and we keep constantly coming across them.
And there is practically nothing new.
No, there's nothing new. It's just a little bit more of a, like you see how they group things. You wouldn't necessarily put them together. You know, don't talk to the enemy, don't talk to the enemy's friend, don't talk to your friend's wife. It's like, huh? You know, it's like that. Because all these things you can destroy you. You know, don't talk to don't insult the Brahmin, don't insult the Kshatriya, don't insult the snake. So they're groups so you can catch. But in the modern thing, no, they put everything about Brahmins in one place, everything Kshatriyas, everything about snakes in one place. No, but it's grouped according to its effect, what you're dealing, what is the principle that you're dealing with. In other words, the detail are very different, right? But the principle is the same. You understand? So that's what we're dealing with. Yes. Why should we imitate politics? We shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because if we want to imitate politics, then
mercy.
No, there's nothing. Because when they go with that also, it's they'll do anything to get their party into power, even if it's not the best thing. You know? Let us say another party has won. Okay? And so they are, you know, there. And you're the opposition. Okay? Now, according to the political method, let's say they come up with some actually good for the people, you know, policy, some bill, that this is actually good for the people. According to the political system, what should your party do? Because you're in opposition. You should be against it. Because otherwise, if you said, no, yeah, this is a really great rule, we also support this, then you'd be supporting their party. And yeah, see, even they support us, so we're the best. So they won't do that. So even though it's said it's for the people, by the people, of the people, it's not. For the politician, by the politician, of the politician. That's it. So who gets the benefit? Right? That's the point. So we have to be very, very careful to be able to distinguish the ritual from the principle that it's trying to obtain. We have to be able to distinguish the levels of consciousness so we can actually tell what is religion and what is not. Then we have to be able to tell, and you know, in that religion, what is eternal religion, what's for Krishna, and therefore what's not. Because even religion, if it's not for Krishna, is still not special. It's pious, but it's not special. It's like that. So it's we have to be very, very careful. That's why all these things come out, to be able to see the difference. You're trying to refine the intelligence. That's the point. Is atato brahma jigyasa means you're refining the intelligence, inquiring about the supreme. You know, like that. So the atma means the body, the mind, the intelligence, and the soul. Right, so the body then will mean the form that it's in and all the connections and every, you know, all the duties that go with the body. Right? You know, so you have a Brahmin body, Kshatriya body, so they're in a particular situation, what their duties are and all that, so that's there. The mind, what are their feelings in that? Because they're in that situation because of those feelings, and those emotions, what it is they need, that's why they're in that situation. So the reason we say a Kshatriya should do this is because he has those emotions that will be experienced by doing that. So to say, oh, we don't need to do all that means, then you're saying the Kshatriya doesn't need to have these feelings. You know, at the same time, we're talking about people's feelings. So you can see is that it has no connection, no logic, so it's got to be ignorance. Right? There's some lack of information here. Otherwise, how could such contradictory things, we talk one thing and what we do is the opposite. How would that work? So it's a mode of ignorance. Right? You know, so these elements, then the intelligence is the senses, how they're engaged. Your interaction with anyone, including God, is through the senses. So that means that the senses have to be properly connected. So that method of connecting the senses. Because then you're going to have the things, no, you can't connect the senses. That's Maya, right? You know, it'll always come up. That's Maya. No, that's like that. But it's not. You know, just like the brahmachari eats, you know, two buckets of halva. You know, as long as he does a service afterwards, no one's going to say it's Maya. Right? I mean, of course, if he sleeps for 3 days, then we might say, hey, we need to review this this particular, you know, very dear ritual, right, you know? So the idea is that engaging the senses aren't the problem. That's why being a grihastha and engaging the senses is not the problem. It's whether the senses are engaged in a progressive way that that there's a connection to the Lord. And we don't define the connections. God defines the connections because we're connecting to Him. So what He likes, that's what's right. And what he doesn't like, that's not what's right. It doesn't matter if you or your friends or, you know, the local, how you say, you know, council or, you know, the countryside or, you know, pick any other group, you know, the academics or the politicians that don't like, it doesn't matter. Because them not liking it doesn't change the laws of God. It just doesn't change. You know, why is it, where does this idea, even when we take this political thing here, where is the idea that someone should be, you know, above moral suspicion to run for a public office? Where does that come from? It came because just that's the popular thing amongst the modern educated intellectual? No, because the modern educated intellectual, they're the ones that are pushing, you know, abortion, same-sex marriage, you know, anything goes. Like, they're the ones that, you know, you got to support the criminal. He came into my house, and he attacked me with a knife. I pulled out a gun, and I shot him, right? And now I have a case against me that I used unnecessary force. The guy could have killed me with a knife. I protected myself, but I can't even protect myself in my own house against a thief. Why? Because of the common man? No, because of the intellectual, educated person. Not because the common man would say, hey, you know, shoot a few more of them, you know. You know? You know what I'm saying? So the point is that they're saying it's because there's, so it's not them, it's not coming from them. They'll say, no, we want them to be more, but it didn't come from them. Because all the other points is they say, it's great, you know, women can do whatever they like, everybody can do whatever they like, hey, being de facto is fine, you know? You know de facto? De facto means that a man and woman agree to live together, you know, they have children, they're not married. They just live together. And they'll say, oh, that's cool, you know, hey, you know, like that. We're being broad-minded. We don't judge, you know, like that. We don't want to judge like that, but we'll judge devotee, especially if he's senior. But, you know, anyone else doing something honored, we won't judge, you know. We're being broad-minded, you know. So the problem is they don't realize that this concept of this being morally good comes from being religious. So it comes from, at least in the Western thing, from being a good Christian, being a religious person. They don't catch that it comes from there. So that means if it's a religious consideration, so then what would you, if we're going to do that, you know, okay, the Western, what's considered so bad there? Are some of the things that we do that we get our leaders for, would they be considered bad by the Christians? Some would, some wouldn't. You know, I throw it into, okay, the Jews, probably even less, they'd be more liberal. Right? Though they're more orthodox. You know what I'm saying? So where is it? So then why we wouldn't use the origin of religion, which is God, because it says that dharma, what is it? Dharma tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. Dharma comes from God. It doesn't come from somewhere else. Like, where do the Jews say the Bible came from? God gave it to them. God gave it to Muhammad. You know what I'm saying? They didn't say they just went out and they were kicking around in the sand and, you know, just kind of bored, you know, watching their sheep, and then suddenly they, you know, had this great realization, or they found under a rock somewhere someone had taken some notes and they thought, hey, this is cool, you know, and said, you know, let's make this our religion. You know, stuff like that. No, it didn't work like that. Also, God, religion comes from God. So then why, if we're approaching God as Krishna, we wouldn't take religion as Krishna gives it? You know? But the point is at least take it from somewhere. But you know, understand? My point is the modern concept of this political and all these things, what's politically right and what's managerially accepted, is not based on God, His creation, the Veda, the Shastra, anything like that. It's based on their little bit left of sentiment that came from religion. But their only consideration is the economic and political repercussions, nothing more. Because there, it's like, if we have somebody who's not good and we remove him, that's what they do, is because you're worried about your political, your social standing. You're not worried about getting the right, what's right and wrong. You're simply worried that your political platform is heard. Whether it's good or not, that's not there. Does that make sense? So what we're saying is that this idea where morality stands on its own, this is what I mean by when I say morality stands on its own, this last, you know, 20-minute diatribe here, I think it is that it's it means that it's not based actually on Krishna consciousness, on Prabhupada's instructions, on Krishna's, they'll take it over, no, but here it says that, but that's not the reason they're basing it, because if it is, then they would take the other things that go along with it. Yeah, they're saying the Brahman should have all these good qualities and not deviate from that. But it also says here, you know, how do you say? Let him not despise himself on account of former failures. But that's what they want you to do. They want you to remember your full life that you did this. I mean, otherwise, why is it now? It's like you go, okay, you know, we were thinking, you know, this devotee, you know, maybe he should be the leader. No, back in 82, you know, he did this to that Grihastha couple and threw them out of the temple. You know, it was 9 o'clock at night, it was raining, and they said, get out of here. So he's unqualified. But that was 82. This is 2012. It just happens to be 30 years later. You know, can people change in 30 years? Just without, just karmis, could they change in 30 years? Yes. Now, what happens if you're chanting Hare Krishna? Would that speed up the process? Would that add anything? No, 20 years ago he did this. He has to pay, and he has to pay eternally. We were so disturbed. It's raining. There were no taxis out there. You know, like that. Where do you go at 9 o'clock at night with your wife and two kids? I mean, it is a problem. It is stupid. Why would they do that? They'd tell him to go in the morning. In fact, you'd give him money. Garga Muni, if he didn't want somebody in his temple because they didn't belong there, he'd ask, where are you going? And then give him the money and send them off. That's intelligent. Right? Because he never had any problems from that. You know? So it means the other thing was uncultured. But now can you tell the guy, hey, that was uncultured, don't do that. And if he has a question, why? What's wrong? They were nonsense. they were creating so much problem in the temple, but still, they're devotees. You know, everybody has their, you know, their mundane attachments and ways of doing things that aren't necessarily ideal. And so if he dealt in a way that you didn't appreciate, doesn't mean that you deal badly. It just means that, you know, if you've come to the conclusion they don't belong there, then remove them. But you remove them in a proper devotional way. You know what I'm saying? But it'll be there. No, he can't do this because of that. And that's a reality. So the problem is what has that got to do with the power of the holy name, the devotional process, Vaishnav culture and all this? So that basically what we're saying is anybody does anything wrong, one, you'll get no support. Two, you know, you'll have no standing. There's no shelter. You'll have no identity. And so therefore, with all that, now, you know, go on. No, we're encouraged. You can chant. You can be devotional. You know, on your own. Yes.
It reminds a little bit about this. You know, in Christianity, you had this long discussion about whether there is eternal hell.
Yes.
And it seems to be in this.
It is. That's why I quote it. That's why much of the time I'll always bring it back to the Protestant Christian perspective. So devotees, by philosophy, are Vaishnav. But by culture, there's some, you know, made-up form of, you know, Protestant. You know, and it's not even the same. That's the thing. At least you get one denomination. You know, they're all Lutherans, or they're all Presbyterians, or they're all Calvinists or something, you know, Baptists. But here it's like each one is something different, you know. So Unitarian, maybe, right? You know. Does that make sense? So that's the problem here. Is no, you can't move on. You can't purify. You can't move forward because you did this. And then the thing is that, no, but the people. So since when do we worry about the people? We worry about what does God say? What do the acharyas say? What do the senior Vaishnavas say? And then the people should bring their mentality in line with that. Right? If Krishna says, even he's committed a sinful act, he's still saintly. That's what God says. We have to bring our mentality in line with that. But we say, no, he's eternally damned. Good, go ahead and try to see if it works.
This morality is based on that one should be, in our society, the leaders should be those who are most popular among the masses of the people.
But they're not the most popular amongst the masses because the mass doesn't even know who our leadership is. Right? It means if a leader only comes to a temple once every 2 years, how popular is he? You know what I'm saying? So if that were the case, then we should reduce it down to, you know, how you say, Radhanath Maharaj and Bhakti True Maharaj and one or two others. And hey, that's it. They're the most popular. So they won. So then, you know, put them on the top, make them the leaders, give them the reins to do everything. Because most of the others, devotees haven't even seen them. They don't even know who they are. Even in their own zones, hardly. You know what I'm saying? So It's not even working, even if you went by a popularity contest. You know what I'm saying? Mayapur, we got GBCs, one we never see, and most people don't even appreciate. So how is that a popularity contest? But then it's like, oh, what does the people know? You know, we know this is the other. So that's what we're saying. Yes, there's authority. So if that's there, if because they don't like you doesn't mean that it's right. They don't know who you are. That's maybe why they don't like you. So just because they don't like you is not enough to say you shouldn't be the GBC, right? Because the GBC is taking the authority to say, no, this is the proper person to do this job. We accept that. That is the right perspective. But if that's the point, is then there's authority, and then there's authority above that. And so that will control then how one behaves. And that authority is Prabhupada and Krishna. You know what I'm saying? It goes both ways. We can't say that this way we accept the authority and this way we don't. No, it's you accept authority or you don't accept authority.
GBC needs to be popular among the people in general.
But then if they want to be popular, then people should see them and know them. It's not popular by the moral issue. Are they popular?
When the people raise their voice or they complain.
Yeah, but who is the people? The people is... But how many people in the congregation?
Everybody.
Everybody, absolutely everybody.
So it's a big concern.
Absolutely, so it means they have a list of names.
If somebody complains...
If one person complains, that's enough to bring down a government.
The whole committee flies there and solves the situation, so it doesn't go back to the GBC.
What happens if one person complains the other way? What if one person in the Yatra complained that the GBC never comes here? So would they fly in the whole EEC to correct the situation? Yes, so that's my point is why is it this only applies to temple presidents? Basically because they've kind of sidelined the gurus and the sannyasis like that. So now you only have temple presidents. Once they get rid of them, then who are they going to go after? Who's going to be the authority that is, you know, causing all the problems in our society? Right? Because the point is you create the community, you're going to have a community leader. Then they'll have to get rid of him and bring out the other one. And get rid of him and get rid, you know. They got rid of Louis the 14th. Robespierre got rid of Louis the 14th. The people cut off Robespierre's head. Right? And then they got Napoleon. You understand? That's how it works. So if there's absolutely chaos, someone who is powerful will just step in and take control. And then all that hard work to get rid of authority over the last 30 years will be out the window.
The idea is that those who come to Krishna consciousness are pure.
They come and they're already pure. Oh, I see. It means you're taking the Madhva angle of vision. The only souls, that there's three kinds of souls, those who are eternally in goodness, eternally in passion, eternally in ignorance. And so only those in the mode of goodness come. Will come to Krishna consciousness. So you don't have to preach, actually. But because Madhva is a bit kind of like Indian and old-fashioned, then we could probably then, if we wanted to westernize it, that's how the Jews think, is the Jews are the chosen people. So you don't have to preach. Jews don't preach. There is no preaching. They just don't, because you're either Jewish or you're not. You know, it's like you're either fortunate or you're not. Like that. And so you don't have to, because those who are they'll be there anyway. So you don't have to worry about that. But at the same time, is then the Jews aren't exactly the best thing for taking this, especially because we're using a Protestant formula. So then it becomes confusing.
Like you gave an example that they killed the Robespierre, but we don't have such a hoax that everybody who comes here is a pure, nice devotee, sincere. And then you have managers who are kind of over the years, like...
Been corrupted and everything.
Rusty, hungry, control,
Hungry. I like that one. You come into their office and they're eating all these got in their drawers or stuff, you know.
Hungry for power and control.
So somehow or another, it's the guys on the top are pure and the guys on the bottom are pure. But that means technically, if you look at it, it's a sandwich. So it all goes together, right? You know, you define the sandwich by what's in the middle. You know what I'm saying?
Get rid of the middle, then we have just good on the top.
No, you have two pieces of dry bread. That's what you have. Wow. Okay. Great. Trying to think what kind of political system this would be. Yeah. Yeah, so somehow or another it's that, you know, how there's the element of authority is there, it's important. So if one would get rid of this, that would actually mean you don't actually understand authority as of value. Because the point is if authority is important, then one would take the trouble to try to train authority. And that doesn't happen with, you know, how you say, a five-day workshop, you know, like that. That comes by personal association and, you know, like that. So then they would take the time to associate with their managers to make sure that they understand the Krishna conscious process so that they could still function in that way and thereby take care of the Because otherwise, the problem is these two pieces of bread. It's not that one takes care of the other. You know what I'm saying? The upper piece of bread expects that the middle, what's in the middle, will take care of. That'll do the nourishment. But at the same time, it's not allowed to do that. At the same time, it's considered bad. It's just, you know, you have a lot of very, very exceedingly conflicting elements.
Like in the supermarket, the top management, when he receives the complaint about some of the managers who are lower ranks, so they go to the customer and they tell him, we will take care of this.
Yeah, so we'll take care of it. That's nice.
Then they kind of get rid of this.
That's what they say. We're, in our example, we're saying that, but I don't think, probably if you go out into the real world, they probably don't get rid of a lot of people. You know, the point is also you have the thing is they may nix the guy for here and then bring him out later. You know, even in the political field, they'll drop him out of this here, but then they'll, you know, they dropped him out of being, you know, this area in the Senate here and then bring him up as a congressman over there. Because they know his value, so then only if it's completely wiped out, then they'll drop him. But otherwise, then they'll constantly bring him up. You know what I'm saying? So they're not doing that. They're not protecting. It means they'll drop, but they still protect their men. So they're not catching that part. So what I'm saying is that you just see a couple of things here and there and then try to make something complete out of it. It won't be very efficient. Yes.
For this punishment of not leading kirtans, there is the idea that if a temple is, for example, giving chance to be kirtan for a person who had, for example, sensual fall down, then it's
Okay, what happens if a second generation kid comes in here and leads kirtan? Will you ban him? Because, you know, last year at one of the parties, you know, one of the Gurukul Melas, he was smoking marijuana. Was the person that you banned from kirtan smoking marijuana?
Maybe.
Oh, no, not that. Yeah, not. But the Gurukuli, good chance he was. Not necessarily, but could have been. But that we don't worry about. What happens if it's a lady? Doesn't matter what she's done, she can lead kirtan. You know, so if everybody's equal, then why not apply this to, you know, the other senior men? But if you're saying is no, he's the man, he's the president, he's that. So then create a hierarchy. So that means the president has more weight than the women or gurukulis. You know what I'm saying? So all it is every time you take a perspective, they just change move the goalposts. You know? Like that. When you go to kick the ball with your foot, then they'll say, no, no, you can only carry it in your hand. And then when you carry it in hand, he says, no, no, you can't run with it. And then when you stop running with it, he says, no, you can't keep the ball more than 3 seconds. You got to get rid of it. You know, so they just keep changing the game. So you don't know if you're playing basketball or whether you're playing football or whether you're playing cricket or whether you're playing rugby. It doesn't matter as long as whatever they say, they're the authority. That's all. So it's like Calvin ball. Calvin makes up the rules as he goes. And why does he make them up? He changes the rules so that he wins. That's all. That's called Calvin ball. You know Calvin? It's a little 5-year-old. Yeah, Calvin and Hobbes. So that's what Calvin does. Yes?
What is the sanction for the philosophy of the
means it would one would have to, you know, show them what's wrong, because devotees do want to go back to Godhead, so much of the time if there is a philosophical deviation, then it's they just don't understand. So if it's pointed out, then you've solved, unless they're completely committed to something, you know, like a, what do you call it, Ritvik kind of thing or something like that. That's then you'll have more of a problem there, but that's still authority based. Because it may be a philosophical misunderstanding, but its application is managerial. It's authority. You know what I'm saying? And it's a philosophy to take down authority and to establish yourself like that. Yes. Yeah.
But the argument could be that the leader, there's more demand on.
No, but we're just talking about doing kirtan. Them having good qualities as a leader, that's what Shastra says. My point is that it's not because Shastra says why they're making these decisions. Right? And then the decisions of Prayaschitta are no kirtan. But the thing is if it's no kirtan because you don't have the character, then, but these others are leading kirtan, they don't necessarily have the character either. So therefore, what is actually the logical basis of that? You know what I'm saying? It should be consistent, right? You know, it's like, at least, you know, it's... you know, let's say you've cheated in money, and so then you pay a fine in money. It makes sense. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying? So it should be connected. It should be. But then what they'll say is, no, it's a prestige to lead kirtan. But is that why someone leads kirtan? Is this prestige? Or it's a devotional process? So they're also mixing varna and ashram here, right? They can't tell the difference. So most of these problems come because you'll attribute one quality to the other, which is wrong. Is that okay? Yeah, okay, so in other words, here, this is very important. If he doesn't despise himself but learns from his mistakes, he'll move forward. But if he's always lamenting about his mistakes, then he'll establish himself in ignorance, and from ignorance he can't do anything. So that means you do something wrong, you have to approach it from goodness, through knowledge what's wrong, and from performing the activity for Krishna's pleasure. That's what's actually going to get the proper result, like that. Let him say what is true. Let him say what is pleasing. Let him utter no disagreeable truth. Let him utter no disagreeable falsehood. That is the eternal law. Okay. Let him say what is true. Right. So true, we understand, true also means what is connected to the Lord. If it's not connected, it's not actually true. So it doesn't, true here, true doesn't mean facts. Right. It may mean facts, but it doesn't indicate immediately facts. Let him say what is pleasing, you know, say how things will work and how people will be pleased. Let him utter no disagreeable truth, means the truth, it may be true, but don't say one that who you're speaking to wouldn't appreciate it. Right? In other words, you want to speak truth that they would appreciate, and from there then build, because there's unlimited ways to approach it. You find one that's there. And let him not utter no agreeable falsehood, something that's wrong, but it sounds great. Don't let him say that either. Right? In other words, how we're speaking here, this is meant for this assembly. It's not meant outside of that. Right? Because outside of it, then you would speak very differently. Does that make sense? So, in other words, for that situation is how you're going to say. What is well, let him call well, or let him say well only. Right? In other words, what's proper, let him say that it's proper. Even if it's just like, yeah, it's okay. But at least you know, okay, it's authorized. Let him not engage in a useless enmity or dispute with anybody. So he shouldn't get into fights just to get into fights like that, you know, just to argue and all that. That's basically useless. or useless enmity means, you know, a fight with somebody who, by being in that, nothing will improve. You know, it's not by winning there's some benefit or anything like that. Let him not journey too early in the morning or too late in the evening, nor just during the midday heat, unless you're English or a mad dog, nor with an unknown companion, nor alone, nor with shudras. Right? So an unknown companion, you don't know where they could be a thief, like that. Right? Too early in the morning, then you know that's the time for your sadhana and that, and it's also a problem, so it'll throw off your sleep at night. It throws everything out. Or too late in the evening, that's when you're supposed to be resting. So the ideal is that you're traveling during the daytime. So when you have a bullock cart, that works really good. You know, if you have a catch to fly, a flight to catch at 2 in the morning, then this rule becomes a little harder to follow, right? You like that. You don't know anyone on the plane. You know, you are traveling alone, though you're with a whole plane full of shudras. So, you know, yeah, so. Let him not insult those who have redundant limbs or are deficient in limbs. Right? Redundant means you have more than you should have, you know, or you have less than you should have. Right? Right? Deficient is less. Nor those destitute of knowledge, nor very aged men. So if someone who doesn't have knowledge, you don't insult them because they don't have any knowledge. Right? You may insult someone who poses that he has knowledge, but he doesn't, so just to wake him up. But someone who actually doesn't have, you don't insult them because, you know, you're more intelligent. Nor very aged men, nor those who have no beauty or wealth, nor those of low birth. A Brahmin who is impure must not touch with his hand a cow, a Brahmin, or fire, nor, being in good health, let him look at the luminaries in the sky while he is impure. Right? If he has touched these while impure, let him always sprinkle with his hand water on the organs of sensation, all his limbs and the navel. Except when sick, he must not touch the cavities of the body without a reason, and he must avoid to touch the hair on the secret parts. Let him eagerly follow the customs which are auspicious and the rule of good conduct. Be careful of purity and control all his organs. Let him mutter prayers and untired daily offer oblations in the fire. No calamity happens to those who eagerly follow auspicious customs and the rule of good conduct. To those who are always careful of purity and those who mutter sacred texts and offer burnt oblations. Let him without tiring daily mutter the Veda at the proper time, for they declare that to be one's highest duty. All other observances are called secondary duties. All right, so in other words, studying and teaching the scriptures, or preaching, and japa, we can see Manu has again and again said these are the highest duties. Right, so we see is here when Prabhupada talks about, we're preachers, so that's the highest thing. Other things are not so important. So Manu says the same thing. It's not like Manu says, no, all these second, they're just as important. No, he's saying it exactly himself. But the point is all these other duties have a place, right? It means they all have something that they do something in your life, because preaching, but then you have to brush your teeth, right? So now for a preacher, would it be better he brushes his teeth anytime that he doesn't care, but he might brush his teeth at noontime, so it'd be bad for his teeth? Or no, or would it be good that he is careful of that and brushes at times when it won't be bad for his teeth. So therefore, you know, he'll have, you know, his teeth will last longer, and it's also helpful in preaching. Right. Yes?
Since Sankirtan is congregational helping, it's sometimes considered that Kirtan is the actual self-realization process and Japa is secondary.
And what's secondary?
Japa.
Or chapa. So japa, chapa, and yapa. So all of these three, yes, they're the most important, but at the same time, is it must be balanced, because the point is your chanting is for your benefit, but you've benefited yourself, you should benefit others. But if you're not benefiting yourself, what does it mean that you preach? Sankirtan means you're telling everybody to chant Hare Krishna, but if you don't chant Hare Krishna, then what's the benefit of you telling them? It means it's a good thing that you're telling them, but it'll have much more effect if you're also doing it. So the two go together. Sankirtan means so many people who are chanting their japa get together and organize themselves to preach to everybody. Does that make sense? That's Jiva Goswami's explanation of a Goshtianandi. A Goshtianandi is a group of bhajananandis who get together to preach. So someone who's good in their own bhajan, they're a powerful preacher. Does that make sense? Yes.
In group of devotees, I've heard one thing they said, we come together not to preach but to relish. Like we chant together.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. To preach but to relish.
Yeah, you could say that. But by doing that, it's preaching. But if you go on Harinam, you're relishing, but you're relishing so that others can take part. Because if you have the kirtan here, those who know and come here will get the benefit. But for those who don't know, then you take this same process out on the street. So then, yes, we're relishing, and so therefore, you know, others, but we also make it so that others will, you know, have a tendency to listen or to notice, or, you know, therefore we, you know, dress nicely, sing nicely, are orderly, you know, or you add things to it, you know, banners or, you know, I think they used to do in Paris, they dress someone up as Krishna and Balaram or Radha and Krishna, and then they'd be in the front. You know, they all do all kinds of things to catch attention that people would notice. But yeah, the point is we're relishing. Because if you're not relishing, then how you'll explain to someone else it's good? Otherwise it just becomes a ritual. You should chant as a ritual. And by the ritual of chanting, then you'll go back to Godhead. No, it's by, because you relish the chanting, that's why you'll go back to Godhead. Is that okay? Right, so again, he brings out the primary duty, right? So in other words, it's your own studies, your own things like this. So, but in this, it means study. It means that you're studying this. You're teaching it, right? So the preaching is there. But if you haven't studied, what do you preach? And if you're not chanting, then where will the potency come from? Okay. Far from his dwelling, let him remove urine and ordure. Far, let him remove the water used for washing his feet, and far the remnants of food and the water from his bath. Early in the morning, only let him void feces, decorate his body, bathe, clean his teeth, apply karulim to his eyes, and worship the gods. Right, so here it's mentioning that in the morning you should do these things like that. But if there's a need, then you can. It means you're going to bathe in the evening, but to do all this, you know, things like that. Let him go to visit the images of the god. That doesn't mean you don't take a bath. It means that you should, ideally, you should, when you get up in the morning, you go to the toilet at that time, and you don't go during the rest of the day. Right? It probably mentions if you go to the toilet once, you're a yogi. If you go to the toilet twice, you're a bogey. And if you go to the toilet three times, then you're a rogi. Right? Rogue means sick. Bogey means enjoyer. And yogi means, you know, sense controlled. That makes sense? Yes?
How about doing some sadhana and then later going to take breath?
If you stay awake and you're up really early, you get up at, you know, 1 or in the morning, then you do a little something and then you take your bath, but you still have to wash your mouth and feet and hands before doing that. But the point is if you stay awake. If you don't, then better get up, take a bath, and then do. Right? And if you're going to be tired, then get up, either go to bed earlier or get up later. Let him go visit the images of the gods and the virtuous Brahmins for the sake of protection as well as his gurus. Right, so he should always be visiting the temple, devotees, like that. And that'll be, and the gurus, so that is actual what is protection. Let him reverently welcome venerable men who visit him, give them his own seat. Let him sit near them with joined hands, and when they leave, accompany them, walking behind them. Does that make sense? So this is how you take. So you receive them, you give them the proper place, you give them whatever it is. Then you always be near them and like that. And then when they leave, you go. Let him untired follow the conduct of virtuous men, connected with his occupations, which has been fully declared in the revealed text and in the sacred tradition, Smriti, and is the root of the sacred law. Right? So conduct is the root of the law. Right, being able to follow that law. So having good conduct, that's there. Does that make sense? And the main law is this hearing and chanting. Through virtuous conduct, he attains long life. Through virtuous conduct, desirable offspring. Through virtuous conduct, imperishable wealth. Virtuous conduct destroys the effect of inauspicious marks. For a man of bad conduct is blamed amongst people, constantly suffers misfortunes, is afflicted with diseases, and short-lived. Right? So here, a man of bad conduct is blamed amongst the people. So where did that come from? The Shastra says it. So that's why I keep asking, why do they say? But the authority is not scripture. The authority is some, the Republican or Democratic, American, political party. So that's not so good. Yes.
What if devotee says, well, I like to be kirtan, the lies, I like to preach or give certain kind of lectures. And it also arrives when japa is.
But Prabhupada didn't say that, so therefore it won't work. The point is it's just like, I think it was in Calcutta, Bhagwat Das, he was the president, and Janmashtami program was coming up. It was a very big program, so getting up in the morning, taking his bath, eating, and going out and collecting. Coming back late at night, just going, eating something, going to bed, and getting up in the morning. So this had been going on for some time. He's making the arrangements and all that. And then Prabhupada called him and says, "Are you chanting?" And he says he's not able to chant properly during this time because, the collection is so important. And Prabhupada's point was, is if you're not chanting your japa, then these other things actually don't have much meaning. You know what I'm saying? So, does that make sense? So one couldn't say that, I will get the mercy by doing this. So, yes, you could say that they're engaging in some way, so that's good. So if they take part in the kirtan, whether they chant japa or not, we won't complain. If they're preaching, then what aspect are they preaching or what context are they preaching? Because if they don't value, if they're talking about the importance of chanting Hare Krishna and their exposure to the people is the kirtan, which they do, then that'll work. But if it comes up to things like their personal sadhana of chanting japa, then they might be a bit weak in that. But at the same time, they may have full faith in it, just can't do it. So you would have to see the engagement. But they shouldn't say, well, it's enough for me. You know what I'm saying? It would be a matter of that's all they can do, you engage them in that, because that's what they can do.
Preaching I'm talking about here is doing school programs.
School programs. But what do they do in the school program?
They give them an introduction lecture about, it's part of their school
class. Yeah, but I'm saying they do just talk about, we're not the body and God, and get them to do a little kirtan, take prasad, and that's it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, so then I would say is that kind of thing, as long as it has results, then I would say fine. that kind of thing is there. You know, maybe giving a serious class to the devotees on the glories of chanting the holy name, they might not be as, you know, leave that to Sachinandan Maharaj, you know, maybe they shouldn't do. But I would say something like that, if it's a matter of engaging, then do, but they should drop the element that, you know, if I do this, then that's enough, and I'll get, no, it's a matter of, this is all I can do, so, you know, one would hope that Krishna and Prabhupada would be pleased, at least, you know, whatever little you can do. You know what I'm saying? Instead of saying it, you know, arrogantly, well, this is enough, and it's good enough as any other process. No, this is all I can do. And so, but, you know, I'll try to focus on this nicely, and then hopefully in the future, by doing this, then the chanting process will become easier. Does that make sense? So they can be engaged, but, you know, you would just have to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, because if that mentality is there, that it's like kind of hard, I don't need.
Yeah, so that's the point, is that it has to be made clear to them, they shouldn't go that down that road. But if this is all they feel comfortable doing now in their service, then do that. But don't rationalize it in saying that's all that's needed to be done. No, that's all you can do. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, you know, the temple has, you know, two devotees in it, so all they can do is, you know, make, you know, two offerings a day to the deity. But you don't say, well, that's perfectly fine. No, that's all they can do. But if they had more people, then they would make more offerings. Are you saying? Does that make sense? So it's a matter of that's all they can do. So, okay, we'll recognize that, but don't make it into a philosophy. Yes?
Just an example that we had problems in the temple. Minister Krishna Chetrapur said, okay, but you have to come up to the standard at one point. You don't keep it like
like
the standard
thing. Yeah, like in Delhi, they only, I think, used to do, I'm not sure, I think there were like one or two offerings a day, that's all there was. You know, because I think the devotees would be, there's like three devotees in the temple, so they'd, I think, do the Mangalartik, do the puja, and something like that, and then maybe someone else would cook breakfast or something, they'd offer that, then they'd go out all day and preach, then come back in the evening, and then, you know, maybe offer some fruit or something, and have the evening artik, and so that's all they did. Like that. But now you see they have a monster temple with all the, you know, the all proper offerings and everything like that. So it wasn't that they thought, well, that's good enough. No, they thought that this is all we can do now. You know? So it's not that, oh, hey, they did that in Delhi, so we can start off with big deities and start off with nothing. No, it's just somehow or another ended up like that. But we shouldn't plan it like that. You know, we shouldn't plan. It's like, well, you know, we'd like to have a kid, but we can't take care of him. And, you know, so, you know, we recognize that it may be, you know, disturbing to his, you know, proper development, you know, not growing up properly with a mother and father and all that, and then all the bad association he might take up, you know, drugs and other things. But, you know, I have read some books, I remember in seventh grade, that, you know, there were some kids that grew up in the kind of the ghetto situation like that, and then they became very prominent, you know, citizens in society and all that. So, you know, it means, you know, so it could work. You know what I'm saying? So you wouldn't do that. You know, it's like you don't have the facility, you don't start. But if the facility is there and somehow or another it drops, so that then you do what you can, but you don't just immediately think, okay, no one's here, so we'll just drop the standard. No, you should try to get the people to for the standard. Yes.
So when you start in a situation when you have people who take everything, or something happened that these people are running away or something?
Yeah, but then why are they running away? That you would have to see. Why are they running away? Why doesn't anybody want to stay? What's wrong with the situation? Because otherwise, you know, is it anything to do with the management? Is it anything to do with lack of understanding? You know, is it offenses on their own part? What's actually going wrong? And correct it. You know what I'm saying? In other words, there's a standard. That's why Prabhupada wasn't so enthusiastic to immediately, you know, walk in with the whole package. But, you know, it's kind of like you get a few devotees and immediately we want to build a big temple, all the deities and all that. But we don't have the facilities. Prabhupada wanted 100 pujaris for Krishna Balaram. That was three altars. He wanted 100 pujaris. And he even said, made an announcement, anybody who wants to stay and be a pujari can. It doesn't even matter if your temple president or GBC doesn't like it. You can stay. Like that. Because he wanted 100 pujaris. Because this is the main temple, right? Vrindavan, Mayapur, and Bombay. These were like main where the public would see. So he wanted really high grade. So the pujaris would do the cooking. They'd do the artiks, they do the kirtan, they would preach, they would, you know, in other words, all the temple things that are going on, the pujaris would do everything.
How many they have in Tirupati or Srirangam?
That I'm not sure, but there's hundreds. Yeah, there's means you have the temple, the first ring around the temple, those are all Brahmin houses. You know, so they all are, you know, varieties of levels of Saivites in the temple. Like that, hundreds. Puri, I think, has 2,000. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's taken more seriously. That's why it's, you know, these worship is big. Because a lot of pujaris and the standard is maintained. So this idea of maintaining the standard, it's not a matter of, well, being practical, it's not there. We have to organize it so that it always is. You know, just like the family, it's like, it's not like, oh, here, you know, I lost my job, so, you know, it's okay, it's cool, you know, we'll just eat once a day, you know, and that's okay, that's all right, you know, like that. You know what I'm saying? Like that, it doesn't work. It's like you have to feed them. You have to have the birthday parties. You have to, you know, go visit the relatives. You have to do all these things. They have to go see the dentist and the doctor and have warm clothes for the winter. It's not a matter of, well, you know, it's not there and it's like that, so it doesn't matter. You know, in other words, it's like that. Is some adjustment has to be made, then that has to be done very carefully. The point is. We shouldn't so enthusiastically establish. You know, like in Russia, there's 100 temples. They all have Gornitai deities. Why? They don't even have devotees to worship them. It's just that over-enthusiasm to all, everyone will be inspired. You know, somehow or another, inspiration is the perfection.
They say Prabhupada distributed freely Gornitai deities.
He did do that. And how big were those Gornitai deities? How big were those ones that he talked about? He talked about it. And I think somebody started it a little bit and did something. He was saying you make these small ones. They're complete. All their clothes, everything like that, hair and all that. And so he says they just keep them on their shelf. You know, like how they have the Buddha deities? People get the Buddha deity and, you know, just put an incense or rub his stomach or something, you know. And so then you know, his thing was that you have these, and if every day you just take one stick of incense and you know, show it for them, then you'll get all auspiciousness. So that was the point, was that they were doing something connecting. But that wasn't full temple worship. So if you want to have a pair of deities, you know, that are 6 inches tall on your altar, fully dressed, and all you do is offer one stick of incense every day, I won't complain. You know what I'm saying? Or I'm talking about, you know, 3 foot tall, you know, or 2.5 foot tall, how you say, marble deities, you don't have any clothes on. You know what I'm saying? That's deity worship. This other is just, you know, like something with the home, like the kids have, they have their deities and they copy and do something so they get benefit. It's different. Krishna will see it's different. You know what I'm saying? It's just like this. Let us say, the man is at home, you know, man is home, you know, the wife's not there, and all there is the three-year-old kid, and it's the father's birthday, you know, and so the kid, you know, somehow or another, you know, brought out some of his, you know, favorite toys or, you know, this and that, and, you know, and he had, you know, a pack of chips sitting in his closet, he gets them out, and so, you know, Dad, I brought you all my favorite stuff, you can play with my toys today and eat my chips, you know, because it's your birthday. Now, would he think that's nice? He thinks it's great. Now, what happens if, you know, the wife is there and he has, you know, how you say, you know, it's 18, you know, 19 or 20-year-old kids and stuff like that, and, the other friends and relatives who are very close and intimate, and then on his birthday, then they, you know, go into the closet and dig out some old toys and, you know, find an old pack of chips that wasn't opened. Hey, wow, this is still here. Wow, I thought we ate that, you know, 6 weeks ago. So, yeah, I don't know how we missed that. But hey, bring it out. It's birthday today, you know. And then he was going to be pleased? Will he be?
No.
So the point is it goes by the thing. When you have a temple and you have deities like that, then you expect to do it properly. But if it's just the home environment, you have that. So if you're saying it's a temple, but we're following that level of worship, then it means that level all the way down, not that, you know, we have on one side it's this, but on this other side it's that. There must be consistency. Does that make sense? So that's why, you know, the Panchatattva pictures are really good. Like that. But if you add in that, then that's nice. Yes?
So what is the... I also heard about these Gornitai dolls, which you were just speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the...
That's being distributed to karmis who don't know anything about it. That doesn't mean now, oh, that means that we can do like that ourselves. We know what they are.
Mm-hmm. But when the spiritual master give permission for something, is that then it's not bona fide for everyone?
Let us say that you got married, so now you have a position. If you want, you can have kids. So therefore, it's for anybody. So anybody can go out and have sex with somebody else that's not their gender and have kids, right?
That's what people are doing. But
is that right? Is that what the spiritual master meant? Okay, so the point is if that was what he meant, why did he talk about the 64 items of worship? Why did he talk about the Shalagram? Why did he talk about he's that small, and if you don't worship him all that, then that's an offense because you can offer it? Why would he talk about making the Archanpadati to explain the process of deity worship? Why would he do that if it's that? So in other words, the karmis who don't know, and so therefore they are going to buy tchotchkes, right? Now, if I walk into any grihastha's house, a lot of what I'm going to see is just interesting looking things. Has no relevance actually. They're just to add some atmosphere to the house, right? Right? So now if some people in doing that process connect that to Krishna by getting these Gornitai dolls, and then they also offer the stick of incense every day, so wouldn't that be an improvement? Okay. Now a devotee who actually knows what is deity worship and Krishna is the center of their life, and all they do is offer one stick of incense while, you know, they just bought their wife, you know, what do you call it? Dior Miss Cherie and all that, and they get some, you know, chemical stuff, the cheapest one from Loy Bazaar, and like that, and you know they just bought their wife their Gucci bag and this and that, and just did so many other things, but Gornitai get nothing. So then is that the standard, right? So these other people, to them it's just a tchotchke, it just sits there. That's all there is. All it does is add something to the house. And then it's said that if you offer this incense, it's good luck. So, you know, many people do that.
So could I...
You understand?
Yeah.
Can you distinguish the difference?
Yes,
sir. Okay, very
so
good. As long as they're fully dressed and all that.
And then please offer a glass of water and incense.
If you can get them to do it, then why not? If they would do it, then yes. But if not, then don't. Then better they have a book sitting there than deities. Because the point is it's presented that they understand that this is something to respect. You know, just like, you know, the little Buddha, they would respect that. There's a culture that, you know, the Buddha is respected, so they wouldn't deal improperly. You know what I'm saying? So if that same mood, they're dealing with this Gornitai, it could work. You know what I'm saying? But there's that responsibility to get that across to them, not that you just sold them the thing or just gave them. You know what I'm saying? With one thing comes the other. If I say cook lunch, then that, along with that, goes the whole thing that doesn't mean that it was just cooked. It meant you know, it gets served, people eat it, dishes are washed, marketing is done, menus are made, schedules are made, you know, and it's made according to what's the season, the people eating, the number of people, the, you know, the kind of people, the kind of occasion. All that is inferred by saying, cook lunch. You know what I'm saying? But we'll take it that it just means, oh, hey, well, we can do this and we'll make a profit off of making these deities and people will all get this and, you know, we'll do that in Hari Bol and now we've done so much preaching. You know what I'm saying? But its point is you have to make sure that it makes some kind of a presentation that when they see these Gornitai dolls, that the presentation and the wording is attractive, that they would want to have them and would want to offer this service. You know what I'm saying? So that's where you use all your newspeak wordsmithing to create something that is very attractive, that they would want to worship the deities. Does that make sense? With that, yes.
Should you, when you offer prayers, it should be done to the idols, or it's a guru whom you should read prayers?
Both. Why not? It means our approach to Krishna is through the guru.
Right.
They're both right. But the point is your approach to the deities is only through the guru. So you're offering your respect to the spiritual master by his grace only, then we can worship the deity.
And one question more. I would hear a lady telling me you should not keep two idols or the two pictures of the same deity.
No, this is Shaligram.
Okay,
it's a rule for Shaligram, and now we can't keep two. You can't have two kids because then they'll fight over who's the superior kid. Like that, two shoes, right? One shoe will fight over. No, I'm the shoe. No, I'm the shoe. Like this, you know what I'm saying? It's you don't have two Shaligrams. You can have one, or you can have three. You don't have two, because Shaligram is supposed to be the center of the worship, because all the rituals go there. So who is the prominent one? Because you're going to use somebody's mantra to worship. So which one are you going to use? So there's always a confusion there. So that's why there's one. But you, if there's two, then it could, why not the other one? You know what I'm saying? But if there's one, then that problem's solved. Or if there's three, then it's natural there's one and then, you understand? So two pictures, this is that. This is taking a fine rule of, you know, rasa between one Shaligram Srila and another, and now starting anything with two, you know, it's like this.
I
this.
Okay. The other day, there was somebody who told me, don't keep two together, it's inauspicious.
I've never heard. If that's there, then most Hindu altars on the planet would be inauspicious. No, it just means this, it's like this. This pillar is Krishna. What does the pillar do? It holds up the roof. So that dead matter is not actually doing it. It's Krishna's potency is in it. So now Lakshmi has defined that a pillar of this much mass or of this much density, then for this particular weight, will hold it up. So therefore the form is identified by her and the potency of that strength is his. So that is Krishna and his internal potency functioning right there. That's what's actually there. Now, you don't notice it, it's a pillar. It's just that dead matter. You notice it, then there's that Brahman level, there's that Krishna's potencies, that it's him as the masculine, her as the feminine. You know, so you're dealing with Parabrahman. Right? If you understand as well, we're following those rules, and so therefore we make that endeavor and build the column properly, then that you're dealing with Paramatma, right? If you understand that as Krishna is the person, it's his potencies that are there, then you're dealing with Bhagavan. You're, through Brahma, through the pillar, you're seeing Brahman, you're seeing Krishna. So when you see like that, Krishna is there. If you don't see like that, Krishna is not there, just his energies are there. So the dolls, so when they go up there and offer, then they're there. And when they'll accept that, and when you're not doing it, they're not there. You know what I'm saying? They are non-different from the form, but unless you're rendering some service, then where's the reciprocation? So it's not like the installed deity. But when you interact, then you get that benefit, is you're dealing with Krishna. The installed deity means whether you're interacting or not, he's there. That's what installed is. You know what I'm saying? So the uninstalled means he's just standing there as, you know, as just some statues until you come along and render worship. Then he's there. And if you don't render worship, he's not there. You know, other than his form is him, but unless someone's appreciating that, where's the reciprocation? Right? But here, the deities are installed. So even if you're in the next room and busy, you're getting the benefit of being in the temple with the deities, so you're purified. But if you just have these deities at home that aren't installed, then unless you're worshiping or recognizing their position, you're not getting the benefit of their association. Perceive, yeah, means him as a person is only there if you perceive him as a person. If you don't, then he's just there through his energies taking care. And as a person, he's interacting with the devotees in his pastimes. But if you recognize then him as a person, that's how Prahlad Maharaj can say, yes, Krishna's in the pillar. And so then Hiranyakashipu attacks the pillar. And so then Krishna comes out of the pillar because Prahlad's seeing him. Right? If Prahlad wasn't seeing him, and just Hiranyakashipu happened to be walking through his temple and he got upset about something and hit the pillar, and Nrisingadev wouldn't have jumped out because it's a pillar. You know what I'm saying? But because Prahlad is seeing Krishna in the pillar, therefore, when he hits the pillar, Krishna comes out. Does that make sense? Yes. No, they're installed or temporarily installed. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. It's when you're worshiping, they're there. And when you're not worshiping, they're not there. That's the meaning of temporarily installed.
Does it mean that when I do my morning puja and everything, and then when I go to work, then Krishna's not there anymore? But then when I come home, it doesn't show up until I burn incense? Or is he still there in the morning time?
How much is he there? Where's the interaction? So between themselves, they may keep themselves busy, but it's not because of you. You understand? So you don't necessarily get the credit. If it's a matter of you try to make a nice arrangement so they'll be happy during the day as you go out, then that benefit is there because you've made that arrangement. If you do the puja and then walk out and don't worry about that, then what's their obligation to stay? You know what I'm saying? That's why, because you didn't offer them anything or do anything, that's why there's no problem. But the installed deities, if you don't offer them their noon offering, there's a problem, because they're sitting there waiting for it. But at home, they're not waiting for it. So when you show up with something to eat, then they're there and they eat it. So when you're thinking about them, caring about them, then they're there. When you're not, then you don't have to worry about it. So it's not that that's just an ideal. See, we always have to see is that this personal element, it means it's just like this. Let us say, you know, you're sitting here and someone else, who a friend of yours, is sitting on the other side of the room. And you're doing what you're doing, they're doing what they're doing. Are you interacting? No. But if, you know, something happens, or, you know, they're doing something, they drop something, it makes a sound, so you look up and see them and you make eye contact, so they smile and you smile. And then you go back to your work, they go back to yours. So there's no interaction. You know what I'm saying? But an installed deity means they're there, and the whole point is your interaction with them. So you should be seeing that at every moment of the day, that there's some way that their service and their comfort is going on, because that's the point. They're there. Right? The difference is here, then it's done according to the standards, because you're dealing with God. At home, He's your guest. So as much as you can in your environment take care, then that's what you do. So in other words, God is the permanent atiti in your house. So like you would take care of an atiti, that's how you take care of God. So that's why you come home in the evening and you do kirtan, you give something to eat, you do something in the morning. So when you're there, some attention is given. But if it's just occasionally you do, or, you know, the three-year-old kid is doing something and, oh, isn't that cute? And, you know, stuff like that. Is it cute to you as a mom? Is it cute to God? You know what I'm saying? Maybe, may not be. You know, it's like, I think it was Saraswati was doing Ratha Yatra. Like, I think Saraswati, you know Saraswati? Malati's daughter. He had small Jagannath with a rope tied around his neck and then just dragging him on the ground. So in her mind, it's Ratha Yatra. You know, the cart and everything's there. So for Jagannath, it is Ratha Yatra. For everybody else, it's like, what's going on here? Like that, you know? So in their mind, so that's the thing, is it is working there. But that when it's not, then it's not happening. So there is this element, but you're trying to, that's good, but you're trying to regulate it that it's not whimsical. Like the child is worshiping, it's whimsical, right? But they're a child, so they can't regulate themselves, so it's okay. But an adult has to regulate themselves for their work, for their family, for everything else, right? So therefore, you'd want to regulate to make sure that your standard of worship is therefore always on that level of when you are inspired. Does that make sense? So when you are inspired and you do the worship, the idea of regulating is that you'll always function at that level of worship. Does that make sense? So you'll always get that benefit. So it's not a matter of, well, how little can I get away with. It's a matter of how do I engage that I'm inspired. Right? You understand? So this is the point, is that this element we were talking before of inspiration, it comes because that is inspiration's madan mohan, that we're attracted to Krishna. Right? That has meaning. But what I was talking before, when I criticized inspiration, it just, somebody felt like it. It's not necessarily connected to Krishna. So what is that? What is the meaning of being inspired in something? You know, just because, you know, the kids out on the street are inspired. You know what I'm saying? So is that enough? No, it's inspired because it's connected to the Lord. That has meaning. You know? Okay, so that says that. So I guess we'll break here for a little bit. Is that okay? Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.